Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
His new album's better than it has any right to be. Josh Brown, you and Parson, thoughts?
You've not stopped listening to this thing.
I love
like
it so much.
I'm a big Green Day fan,
yeah.
You know, and it's way better than their most recent record before then.
Revolution. No, no, the other one. Not Revolution
Father
Radio.
Of all MFers. Yes. You can't even say the title on this podcast. But yeah, really good.
About that.
Yeah. I always want to go see Green Day again because I've seen them twice and they absolutely rule. Mm-hmm. But they insist on doing stadium shows, and to do that, they put together a bill that allows them to get the audience in to, you know, justify one of those shows, but it means the prices are astronomical and you have to go to, like, I don't know, far away, Dublin, to go see Green Day.
Far,
that's
far,
my
far away.
Green Day rant, I suppose.
I've never seen Green Day live. You and thoughts on the history of Green Day?
I like the 90s era.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I've kind of come around. In the moment, I was kind of like not really a big American
when you came around.
Person. When I came around, exactly. Hey. But I wasn't really big on it at the time, but now I'm kind of like, it all rocks, but I've not listened to the new album yet. The only thing I've been listening to for the past 2 weeks is the Miami Vice soundtrack. Because I'm just completely...
You've been in a lovely little bubble.
I'm Crockett pilled now, is what I am, just completely.
Speaking of a lovely little bubble, this is the United Banter Podcast.
United Banter
the
Podcast.
The Untitled Banter Podcast, the UBP, the UBP, the UBP, joined by Ewan Parson. How you doing?
I'm doing okay, I'm coughing up.
Yeah, he's discovered coffee, we'll get back to that. Joined by Josh Brown, how's he doing?
I'm doing all right, thank you very much, nice
we
to meet you.
We should have a quick little Twin Peaks minute before we get to everybody's questions, because people do send in lovely questions, lovely talking points, etc. But Ewan, how are you finding coffee?
Great. Twin Peaks broke my brain.
Yeah.
Now brain coffee pie. Pie coffee.
You brought
brain
some donuts. It was an incredible combo. Sugar donuts, a nice bit of black coffee.
Yeah.
Lovely stuff.
It's that show has wormed its way into my brain now. And now I want to wear every nice garment. I want to stand in every brisk outdoor space. Uh-huh. I want to sample the lovely pine air. I want to have a nice... I made a big pie the other week. That show...
It's such a vibe, bud.
In my head now.
You brought donuts in this morning as well for the office.
Yeah.
It's an absolute revelation because I get all the treats from you and watching it, and also I get to live vicariously through
it. It would be weird if I brought in a giant map of Tibet.
No.
I think it might help. I think it might help with ideation, to be honest.
I was in HMV the other day, and for some reason, they sell the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and I almost bought it because I'm watching Twin Peaks right now, and that's what Dale Cooper's always talking about in that show. And I thought, well, I'm reading all these books about Twin Peaks. Maybe I'll just go whole hog and read the Tibetan Book of the Dead.
I mean, you might as well. It was that one scene, I don't know which episode it's in, where is it Dale Cooper is the detective guy? Just the camera zooms in on a cup of black coffee with a slice of pie next to it. That's what awakened me as well, even before I fully got into coffee across the pandemic.
The episode, because again, I'm in the second season now, but the episode, I fell in love with the pilot. I was having a great time with the episode where I was like, I know that this show is going to be entwined with my very being. Mm-hmm. It was the introduction of the Bookhouse Boys.
Yeah.
And where they're talking about, like, how... you ever wonder, like, why we have so many nice things in Twin Peaks and there's, like, an evil price to pay for it behind the scenes? I was like, that's great. And he gets given a slice of huckleberry pie. And Coop has one bite. And he's like, this must be where pies die and go, like, to heaven. And I feel like it is obvious
in Alan Wake, in Remedy's work, but, like, lines like that are, like, the exact energy that you get out of modern-day Remedy or out of just the general tone of Remedy stuff.
Honestly, man, when I get the time and inclination, I want to do a whole 40-minute video essay on why Alan Wake 2 is the Twin Peaks, the return of the game space. It is.
I'm not bored.
When you get there, double them up. You'll have a cracking time, man.
Everyone listening to our voices, go play play Alan Wake 2, according to the latest reports from Remedy. That thing still needs to recoup its sales.
You've gotten into coffee quite quickly, though. Like, it took me a while to get into it. I know you said, obviously, it's not the first coffee you've ever had, but I remember
it's a different thing.
My dad gave me one, and I thought, this is kind of rancid, but I'll drink it all.
The facial expression right now.
Sam
Lake himself.
Everything's contorting.
I was thinking, what is this? And then a few days later, I was craving it again, and I had another coffee, and I thought, ooh, I feel alive for the first time in years.
I don't know if this is a thing that you guys have, but I find that as I get older, I have an appreciation for things that taste like things and aren't masking themselves. That's a weird
thing. Your taste buds do change a lot.
When I was younger, my go-to bevy of choice would be a cider because I hated the taste of beer.
Right.
And now I can't stand the thought of cider because it's too sweet. I want a drink that tastes like a drink. Quite like the bitter overtones and like the kind of like this, the full-bodied punch of a flavor.
Yeah, man.
I know what you mean.
Very much a thing that your taste buds change as you get older, especially around the late 20s, early 30s, to get more into things that are a bit more sour, a bit more bitter, a bit more rounded, you might say, than something that is directly sweet. Lots of questions coming in, though. First one from Pinky, who says, well, if it isn't a UNB3, let's talk about Dragon's Dogma 2's performance issues. Scott, given that it's your fault, I struggle to play games without 60 frames a second now. Do you think the performance is a deal breaker, and do you think it'll get fixed? All I want is 40 frames a second variable refresh rate before I buy. This is a bit of a deal breaker to me, but you're giving me a face there, Josh Brown.
No, I fully get it. Like, it's not for me, but if you are someone who is at minimum looking for 40 frames per second with a bit of VRR,
just not a horrible 30.
I couldn't fully recommend Dragon's Dogma 2 because, one, yeah, it is targeting 30, and two, it very rarely hits 30 consistently throughout the experience, and I can't, in good conscience, recommend you go out and buy it right this second if that's going to be a major problem for you. And I understand that it would be because the game deserves more than the performance that it is currently outputting because the scale is off the charts. Mm-hmm. It looks absolutely magnificent, but it's just clear that it's not as optimized as it could be.
I do want to laugh. I want to point and laugh at Final Fantasy VII Rebirth's new sharp mode because when Final Fantasy VII Rebirth launched a couple of weeks ago, there's a graphics mode, a performance mode. Performance mode is 60 FPS, but everyone looks like they're made of clay. The resolution is so low, it's very blurry. And that final texture pop never happens for the faces sometimes. It's also based on distance of camera to the character themselves. So immediately, I forget which member of the team it was, got out there and said they would have a new graphics mode. Don't worry, we're going to sort it out. They literally acknowledged that it makes the characters look very scary because their eyes are all sunken into their head. It's a whole thing. And then a couple of days ago, they released this sharp mode. It looks identical. It's a sharp mode to play. It's like if you crank sharpness on your TV, but it's not even that effective. And even that's not very
effective. I was thinking about this because I saw them say pre-release that they were going to release this update to improve performance mode graphics, and then they got it out so quick that I thought, even before I had seen any footage, like, if that can't be right, because if you got this out so quick, why wasn't it in there for launch? This fix can't be that, robust, and evidently, from what you're saying, it's not.
I've gone back and forward from performance. I hate this. I hate this wing of modern gaming. I've talked about it loads, but I've gone back and forward on Final Fantasy's graphics and performance mode. Every time I boot it up, I go between the two, because I'll see a new vista, and I want to see what it really looks like, so I'll put it on graphics mode. Then I'll move the camera, or look around, or move a character, and go, oh, that's horrible. That actually gives me a headache. I feel sick. And I'll put it back on performance mode again. And then I play like 90% of it in performance mode, but adding another graphics option had me last night jumping between all three of them. It's a living hell.
Not a matter of acclimation. Like, I felt like when Gotham
it's
Knights,
Stockholm syndrome.
Like,
but
every
it
time
is.
I come on this podcast, I talk about Gotham Knights. But I remember when Gotham Knights came out, and everyone was losing their rag over the fact that it was like 30. Locked at 30, and there wasn't going to be like a performance mode or whatever. And I admit, when I first started playing it, I was like, this takes a little bit of getting used to because I've been slotted into the performance life. But by the end of it, my eyes adjusted and it was fine. And I think that the lighting and particle effects in that game are really, really impressive.
Yeah.
And there was like a conscious decision to lean into that. So I think we've had this conversation a bunch of times about games like feeling like halfway house committed to not being able to lend itself to a proper full committed artistic vision because it's got to conform to the performance aspect as well. It's weird that we've now got this diverging lines. And I do wonder going forward if maybe it looks like it's going to be like a requirement that every game is going to have to have performance now because of the way that the hardware's going and how we've trained audiences now. But I would be curious to see if like we're going to get more games potentially in the future that were like, we're just going to commit to the low frame rate and that's perfectly valid. I think developers should be confident enough to stick up for that if they can't do a performance mode well in a way that does not reflect what they were initially going for.
Totally, and it's like Final Fantasy's for Rebirth especially, and Remake had it as well, where it really feels like we are upping the frame rate and we're just going to drop the resolution until it's stable again. Like what you would do if you were on a PC or something, and it looks like hell, but at least it plays smoothly.
I mean, I thought 16's performance mode was absolute guff. Like that dropped the resolution down to like 720p at times. It was, I felt like I was, honestly, the first time I put it on, like no joke, just thought I was like, thought I needed glasses. I thought it was a me problem. I booted it up in performance mode and thought, like, is this me? Is this the game? Like, what's going on? And then quality mode sorted it out.
It's worse than 7.
Is it?
Oh, that's way worse.
How can it like, get worse than 7?
I'm noticing than 16, but like, I'm noticing, and I didn't even mind it in 16, but man. I don't know if that was because the overall movie, you were doing more combat more frequently or something, but it's a problem, though.
I'm with you, and like, I am a quality man anyway, but I don't mind if a developer says, look, we've targeted 30 frames per second, this is kind of what we've built the entire experience around, and if that frame rate is stable, I'm totally fine with it. The issue with Dragon's Dogma is they've done that and then haven't even been able to hit 30 consistently, which is a shame. But you mentioned there, Scott, about flicking between them. And this isn't a you problem at all, but like,
I feel like a problem.
To me, that is, yeah.
In pain.
That to me is like just, that will shoot you in the foot, because there's no way, I think, even as someone who loves 30, you can go to 60, acclimatize your brain to what that looks like on screen, and then go back to 30, because if you go back to 30 in the moment, it looks like the jitteriest, most broken thing in the world, but it doesn't look like that if you boot it up in 30 and kind of go with it.
That's
and again,
true.
It's not a you thing, it's just like an issue with that ability to switch on the fly, I think, because I think it makes you, from a gut perspective, go, oh, well, I'm going to stick with 30, but if you kind of give it, 60, sorry, but if you give it time with 30, you might... Your brain will acclimatize, then you'll go, oh, maybe this resolution is way better and makes up for the lack of frame rate.
Yeah. That's my performance RT is what I... If they give me a middleman option, I'm there. Like when GTA 5, which that remaster is really good, by the way, the one that they did for the PS5 and Xbox, and that remaster, it was like performance RT... This is what I want. Give me a little bit of this, a little bit from column A, a little bit from column B.
Totally, like,
because I'm so indecisive.
I think the whole 40 FPS, like... that whole middle ground thing is where I'm at as well. Like Insomniac nailed it on the Spidey games. And for me, it's like even those dropping frames of like a couple of frames, like you're aiming for 30, but you're hitting between 28 and 30. I still feel like I can feel that in the gameplay. That's what makes me feel literally a bit sick when I'm trying to play those modes. Whereas Gotham Knights was at least locked to exactly 30. And it's like, I can go with that if it's locked in. Jack Asbury says the coverage on Dragon's Dogma 2 makes me want to jump in, but I'm wondering if I need to play the first one before I do so.
Personally, I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
I'm biased because I didn't play the first one at all. I have no idea if there are any connections in there I'm missing, but it very much feels like, I said this in the review actually, the impressions that we did, feels to me like a Nier Automata, where that is a sequel, but it's also kind of like a soft reboot of the entire thing. Like, yes, of course, it exists within the same framework, but it's more or less bringing over the mechanics, and correct me if I'm wrong, from Dragon's Dogma 1, and just refining them and kind of reintroducing them rather than continuing a story or like a larger thematic thing, kind of like how Nier Automata did very similar things. So I'm like 25 hours in and I've not encountered any issues with that yet, apart from the very, very introduction where I was confused as to what a pawn was and what an arisen was in terms of the world that was being presented to me, but that was cleaned up quite quickly.
Let the vibe slow. I mean, how many games did we play out of order as kids?
Yeah.
I didn't know who Kyle Katarn was when I played Jedi Academy and I still had a great time. Just let the vibes free. Just dive in.
That's true. In this case, it is. Yeah, it's worth knowing that the general setup for both of these games is like a dragon stole your heart, and you're just supposed to go out and do a whole bunch of side quests, main quest, in whatever order you want. You don't need to be coming straight off Dragon's Dogma 1.
It might. Yes. I mean, you'll be able to tell me more, Scott, but the feeling I get from it is maybe not as extreme as this, but kind of like the Elder Scrolls, where it's like the same framework. It's kind of like following on from what the previous game built, but you don't need to play Oblivion to enjoy Skyrim.
But there still might be references to like Deidric armor, Deidric realms, and things like that. Things that do tie it over. Overall, I think that Capcom want this to be a huge... Scrolls is a really good comparison for what I think they're aiming for, considering the Netflix stuff as well. Question from Toby Lerone, who says, possibly a controversial opinion, but I prefer to watch anime and other non-English speaking shows dubbed rather than listen to their native tongue and read subtitles, enjoying it more IMO and not distracting from the images on screen. Is this sacrilege? Yeah, it's criminal, to be honest. Josh, what do you think?
No, I want to know what you think, because you're the biggest animesman around in this podcast at this moment in time. So sacrilege, hey?
Yeah. This is a very much accepted opinion, very much an accepted part of the law, LAW law in the anime world. Yeah, you don't watch it in outside its native tongue. However, there are some shows that transcend. Dragon Ball, the English voice cast for that, phenomenal. One Punch Man, the English voice actor for Saitama, phenomenal. Vast majority, you're going to want to watch that in the Japanese, in the native. The original.
Come on, Ewan, you're doing faces.
Are you watching dubbed anime, Ewan?
No. Right. Now, this is the interesting thing, because I think there's a move towards having subtitles everywhere at the minute, like in regards to just non-dubbed stuff in general. Mm. If I'm watching something in English, I don't want to have subtitles, because I do think the argument for it distracts from the moving image is fair.
Okay.
But if I'm watching something, I think in general, if it's coming from an international production, I want to listen to it in the actual like native language that it's spoken in. Mm-hmm. But like there is a precedent for amazing anime dubs, like you just pointed out, like Dragon Ball, and like this. I grew up watching dubs of anime, so it's like I don't think it's like sacrilegious, and I don't. I think it's one of those where you just got to experiment a little bit. You got to like find your. I don't think anyone can say definitively you're right or wrong for watching something in a given way unless you have motion smoothing on your TV.
The thing is, it's changed over time, and more recently you've got the likes of Studio Ghibli really invest in like Robert Pattinson's The
Black Heron.
Like he really goes for it, and it's awesome, and like that's awesome, and like there's been quite a lot with Studio Ghibli adaptations where they've got really good voice actors, and actually the art of voice acting comes through, and it's not, some of them are more celebrity based, and you've got people like Robert Pattinson really going for it. It's just that the vast majority, if you're comparing like line reads, like you're specifically translating the way that something is delivered in Japanese to English, those sentence lengths are going to be different, but the recording space is the same because the scene is already shot. So like that can affect the dictation, like the actual sound of it, how fast a lot of that delivery happens. It's very unnatural. Like I get why people would watch something in English, obviously if they're more English speaking, but it's not going to ever come close to the way it was supposed to be delivered in the original recording, for me.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of with you in the way I don't think there's necessarily a right or wrong way to do it, and it's very case by case, but I haven't watched anywhere near as much anime as the next person. Like, I'm very, very casual when it comes to that stuff, but if we're talking about dubs more wildly and wildly,
they are wild dubs.
It's always case by case with me. Like, something like Ghost of Tsushima, like, I put that on the Japanese track rather than the English dub. Yeah,
same with Rise of Ronin.
Yeah, I played Rise of Ronin in English for whatever reason.
Oh, really?
And liked a lot of the performances there. When it comes to like anime specifically, I do think you're right that sometimes the caliber of the international dub just is too big for me to ignore. Like when I watch The Boy and the Heron, I will be watching it with that English speaking voice cast because I'm like, Willem Dafoe, Robert Pattinson, I want to see what these freaks are up to in this movie. And then if I like it enough, I'll go back and watch it with the original voice actors. But I think to me as well, and you talked there about like missing something from the impact of the delivery from the native speakers and the cadence and whatnot. To me, I like the surreality of the bad voice actors sometimes. It kind of gives me Resident Evil vibes, you know, where there's like a little bit of naffness to it. Like I think some of like the more kid-friendly animes I listened to when I grew up, and like the performances from the voice cast is they're kind of ropey.
They're way worse back then. Yeah.
Even in Dragon Ball, man, which I really love the cast of, like sometimes it's a little ropey, it's a little off. It feels like they could have done another take, but that's to me, in a way, part of the charm, is in the same way that the Resident Evil voice acting kind of is at times.
Yeah, I guess I see what I just don't agree at all. But I can't think of a
live action. I really don't like live action dubs.
Right.
Yes.
That always frustrates me.
That's the same feeling.
You get a lot of that
me.
With like older martial arts movies as well, where it's like most of the frequent prints you'll see are like dubbed and they can be frustrating. Mm-hmm. So I much prefer to have like the subs on for that. But
yeah, I think I like how much over the years it's been tret better. Like you've got, like I said, the Studio Ghibli stuff, like getting full casts, actually getting, I mean, I'd always would prefer proper voice actors, even though sometimes you get celebrities actors who can do really good voice acting. But yeah, there's just, initially it was always about, well, you know, the Western markets don't embrace anime, don't embrace anything with subtitles. We need to cater to them, and I was always and still am of the mind of no, respect the original work.
It's a unique to Western thing. Like dubbing is a thing that happens in every market. Like,
true.
It's like it goes beyond just like a Japanese versus kind of Western market perspective. That's the only thing I would disagree with there. Like, you've got,
I mean, specifically for the anime stuff.
Yeah.
I think the difference for me personally anyway, between live action and anime as well. Like, I agree, I would never watch a live action movie or TV show that wasn't initially recorded in English with a dub. It would be subtitles every single time. Mm. But that's, again, this comes from, I think, my own ignorance, because I can get more from the performance from a live action actor. Yep. In terms of, I might not, you know, understand their delivery of a sentence. I might not have familiarity with the cadence or the intonation or what they're trying to convey with it, but from the human elements, I get more information than I do from animation performances, right, in terms of the visuals. So that helps me a lot personally in kind of ascertaining the nuances of that performances, in a way.
There's definitely more to it. It's definitely a wider conversation when you start bringing live action stuff in. I feel like people have harder stances on it when it's dubbing over live action stuff, mainly because obviously the lip movements aren't going to go at all.
Whereas it's so interesting animation because that, like, closer. To me, that is the uniquely like British and American, Canadian, Australian thing, because there are like voice actors who have done like redubs of The Simpsons in like Spanish and German who are like minor celebrities in those countries because it's redubbed there for a reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's never shown with subtitles, which I find is an interesting conversation.
No, totally.
Like, totally there.
I think, same with thinking of in the game space, like the David Hayter is Solid Snake. I forget the name of the dude that is him in Japan or Japanese, but like that guy is obviously, David Hayter's not going to be a big deal over there, but they have their own version of that character. It's always going to be different per medium.
I was just about to bring David Hayter into it because there was a conversation over on Twitter across the weekend about him appearing for a Metal Gear Solid promotional thing from Konami, and people were saying, like, wasn't it interesting and kind of bad when Kojima just kicked him to the curb for Metal Gear Solid 5 after decades of defining that character for a certain audience?
Made him re-audition for the same role.
Absolutely,
and then got rid of him anyway.
I didn't hear that.
Oh, my God.
There's a really good, I don't know who he was talking to, but there's a really good interview with David Hayter. It looks like he's just sitting at a pub on like a webcam interview being asked about it. And he was like, yeah, man, kind of F that guy. Like, what the hell? Like, I wasn't even asked about it.
It's really weird because I don't dislike the Sutherland performance. I think it's fine, but given how he's so like, we're getting like sidetracked here, I guess, but he's so anomalous in that game because everyone else is giving the same level of kind of performance that Hayter was giving as like Boss Snake, like all the previous games. Like, everyone's leaning into that kind of like exaggerated stuff, and you've got Kiefer doing this whole
even then though, like, that version of Snake, and it's not Solid Snake, spoilers, but like the way that thing all rolls out is that, like, I mean, the whole justification Kojima gave was that he wanted someone who was an actor who could do more facial movements and do more body movements and everything else, but they don't, because of the way that character is written, they don't take any advantage of that whatsoever.
Listen, maybe I believe him at the time, but get the hell out of here. That guy has since pivoted entirely to just scanning like Nicholas Winding Refn into his games and getting someone else to do the performance.
He wants to meet the boys.
Come on,
he just wants to meet the boys.
He just wants to meet. If he just said, "Look, I've been to Hayter because I wanted to meet the boys. I wanted to meet famous people," I'd be like, "Sound. You know what? I don't like it, but fair enough. That's what you wanted to do.
It.
At least you're being honest about it. Don't give me this. She breathed through her skin crap. Just say you wanted a sexualized lady.
Just
like
the boobs, Kojima.
Last thing on Kiefer Sutherland. I watched the Kane Mutiny Court Martial the other week, which was William Friedkin's last movie before he passed away.
Yes.
And Kiefer Sutherland kind of gives quietly like one of the best performances of 2023 in that movie. It's currently on Prime through Paramount Plus. If you've got Paramount Plus, I think it's Paramount Plus. But you should go watch it. It's like a based on the play. It's all in like one room, and Kiefer Sutherland plays this captain who was mutinied against at sea.
Nice.
And he is class in it. Reminded me why Kiefer Sutherland is great.
Yeah, I only ever watched Kiefer for the majority in 24.
Yeah.
And then that show that he did with that little child who could see all the red string that connected everybody.
Lost Boys, Phone Booth?
Yeah, but all Phone Booth, yeah.
Young Guns 2.
No.
Oh,
that's probably a whole Kiefer archive that I should get stuck into. Question from Willie Araya, who says, comic book question. Do you have a character you initially didn't like but eventually loved? For me, it was Superman and Damian Wayne. Superman, the animated series, and the DCAU, the animated universe?
Yeah, DC Animated Universe. Yep. Yeah.
Did a lot of heavy work, and now I love the show Superman and Lois, and Damian grew on me as I kept reading and seeing him grow.
Ooh. First of all, I was always there for Damian from day one.
You were.
I love Grant Morrison. I think they're like the best Batman writer mm-hmm, ever. Mm-hmm. Just I was the right age for Grant Morrison's Batman, let's mm-hmm. put it that way. In terms of like characters that I disliked but then came around to, that's like really tricky because on the topic of DCAU stuff, those shows raised me and kind of informed my taste on comics, and they did a great job of spotlighting lesser known characters. Mm-hmm. So that's why with my taste in superheroes, I really gravitate towards kind of like the C and D tier characters, like The Question, like Vigilante, Jonah nice. Hex, like stuff like that. So it's difficult for me to think of, like, I guess with characters that I came around to, I still haven't fully came around to it because I think that the idea of resurrecting Jason Todd is just stupid. But Gotham Knights did a really good job of actually making that resurrection make sense. Yeah. I really, really loved Stephen O. Young's performance as Jason in that game mm-hmm. and what they do with him in terms of not only physically making him distinct compared to the other Bat Family characters, but giving him an interesting arc, actually doing stuff with that. It's the only time that Red Hood has ever made sense to me as a character. I still don't like Red Hood overall, but if we're talking about, you know, interpretations that they may like him, then I guess that
Kim's character writing is so good.
Yeah,
as well.
I'm completely like wanting for other examples here because I just have my characters that I write on the iPhone.
I don't have very many.
One.
I don't think I have. As I'm thinking about it, do you have anyone, Josh, that comes to mind?
Funnily enough, I was going to say Red Hood because when that character was, or when I first became aware of that character, and he was popping up in the movies and the comics and the games and all of that stuff, I just did not vibe with him at all. Mm. There's something about that story combined with that aesthetic design and costume and the kind of, from the outside so looking in, it felt like very edgelordy sort of behavior. But as I've come to read more stuff about him, and especially in Gotham Knights, and he's been fleshed out a little bit more, he feels like less of a caricature, or at least the caricature that I was assuming him to be. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's not like he's my favorite Bat character now, but he's definitely one that I don't mind popping up in things.
Right.
I've actually got another answer for this now. There's two Marvel characters. So one, the Punisher, who I think in context works way better for me than he does when he has that weird baggage around. I think when you actually go into a Punisher thing and you're like, this is the Punisher.
Yes.
It works perfectly fine for me.
Garth Ennis's Max Rona.
Cyclops is another character who gets kind of typecast as like a boring leader, milquetoast figure. But I think most X-Men fans would agree with me when I say this. If you dive into the comics and look at that character, they're really, really cool. Like, they get kind of characterized as this weird conservative presence in the team. Mm. But he's like the most radical dude ever. If there's one comic I'm going to recommend to people who have not been reading comics the past decade, it's House of X, Powers of 10, which is the Jonathan Hickman-led reboot of the X-Men that started in 2019. Mm-hmm. The way that thing kind of, that individual arc is fantastic. The way that the whole X-Men reboot ended kind of fizzled out due to Hickman leaving Marvel again. But Cyclops in that is great. It's kind of like a whole taking the mutant metaphor and being like, we're going to make a stand. You know, we're not going to take humanity's crap again or whatever. Mm-hmm. And there's a great bit where Cyclops has a confrontation with the Fantastic Four. And I was like, ooh.
That's well done.
I've got one more before we move on.
Yeah,
actually,
man, I haven't got any, so feel free.
Quite a biggie. Honestly, Green Goblin, Norman Osborn. Grown up, even though I was Spider-Man, ride or die, was a huge fan of the first movie, and like Norman and Green Goblin in that film, how could you not? Mm-hmm. In the comics specifically, and also in the cartoons, I never gravitated towards him. And when I would be like reading online or reading books that talked about him as Spider-Man's ultimate nemesis, I used to bristle a bit because I just didn't want
I think
him
I'm the same with that, yeah.
That. Like, I was always a Venom guy, you know what I mean?
Yeah, same.
We were Harry guy.
I wasn't even a Harry guy, either.
The Norman Harry stuff is like my favorite Spider-Man stuff.
There was something about just like the Osborns as characters and Green Goblin, his design, his role in Peter's life.
I'm actually
really
totally with you on this.
With it at all, but you might not be with me in a second because I did do a complete 180. Right. Now Green Goblin is like my favorite Spider-Man villain, and I really hope they do that arc justice in Spider-Man 3 if that's what they choose to prioritize, because now I love the relationship between Peter and Norman and Harry and that kind of, you know, Norman filling that kind of father figure role in a way that Peter never had, and neglecting Harry and every permutation of that, whether it's when I was reading the Ultimate Comics and what they do in that to kind of tie the Oscorp, you know, company to wider villains and even further into Peter's story. I've now loved pretty much every incarnation of the Green Goblin, and I know that Green Goblin has an interesting role to play in the recently rebooted Ultimate Spider-Man comic.
Yeah, he does.
Which is getting me very excited. Yeah, he does. So I'm going to jump into those issues as well.
Yeah.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy, because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
I'm trade waiting for those ones. I'm super excited. Last note, Sandman is my favorite Spider-Man character who isn't Spider-Man, and I feel like Sandman does not get... And people forget that Sandman isn't just a villain. Like, he had a whole arc. Like, in terms of, like, what Marvel was before they did the whole continuity resets and, like, we're going to keep our characters in the most marketable, boring, just stale... frozen in time versions of themselves. Sandman had an entire arc where he went from being a supervillain to an anti-hero to joining the Avengers.
Wow.
It's one of the best full-bodied arcs in superhero comics that no one knows about. So I've got a bat for Sandman here as well.
When you mentioned Sandman, and just, I reminded me, I love Mr. Freeze, but my first Mr. Freeze was the Batman and Robin Arnold Schwarzenegger Mr. Freeze, which is such a world away from the animated series
not
Mr.
Quite,
Freeze. Maybe not quite. But yeah. I had such a soft spot for that character anyway, but like I love like a really dark Mr. Freeze, like the whole like feeble
why
guy.
You need to watch Batman Beyond, because they know the arc full circle.
I'll get there, just not right now. Question from Ben Jammer, who says, "Hello, gents. Do you find you have a different mentality when playing games you've purchased versus games from a subscription service? I tend to be a completionist for a game that I've bought, but I'm happy to just play the main campaign for something from PlayStation Plus." Yes, I would say.
Yeah, you want to talk about like the differences between...
Yeah, I view the subscription services, the monthly services, as just a platter, a buffet platter. I'll dip in, I'll grab some vol-au-vents and I'll move on. I might stick around, I might have a bit of a meal, I might get enough of them to fill me up. But if it's something that I've bought that meal, I need to get the money's worth.
This conversation is completely alien to me because I'm not part of any of this nonsense.
You don't buy the subscription ones?
No.
Okay.
I buy the game is mine.
But why do you
I'll
do that
I'll either play it or forget it.
Right, okay. But you find it hard to put something down if you after buying it though,
like, no, if it's like... I have no guilt. I have no shame.
Okay,
full disclosure, I bought Mad Max for £3.50 last year. I played the first few missions and I bounced off it.
Oh, all the rooms to admit that.
They're more or less the same for me. There are some slight differences. I might use a subscription service to jump into, you know, an old Star Wars game for a quick nostalgia hit in the way that I wouldn't if I maybe bought it. Or I might try a different genre.
because of the subscription and maybe bounce off it in a way that I wouldn't again if I bought it, but would I have bought it anyway because it's so different? I don't know. But I kind of treat them the same because I'm just very picky when it comes to what games that I play. I won't play something regardless if I'm not in the mood for it and if I've not been looking forward to it.
Mood is so big.
Mood is so big, right? So whether I get access to that through a subscription service or whether I buy it outright, like, that's always whatever I'm playing is going to be the game that I'm most looking forward to, so it's going to be the one that I will try to get the most out of regardless of whether I've paid money for the actual physical thing or if it's just part of a rolling subscription.
Yeah, I totally get that. I think for me it's always trying to get my money's worth, I guess, especially when games are like £70 or whatever it is. And I get why some people bounce off certain genres because they're not like default meaty enough, like a big open world game versus like a fighting game. Like, I know Cy wasn't bothered about Tekken just because it's just a fighting game. But yeah, I do, for me, that it's a different thing. Question from Screwy Loops, who says, pot noodle on toast man over here. Josh's bread balls are bizarrely nostalgic.
Hell yeah!
I'm going to see Fight Star tomorrow. Any Fight Star fans amongst the What Culture Massif?
Not a Fight Star fan. Liked Busted a lot.
Yeah.
Watched a Busted documentary last year. wanted to go see them when they were playing Newcastle, but never got into Fight Star.
I never got into them, but I did see, I was subjected to Fight Star when I went to see Feeder. Back when Feeder were a thing. They were supported by Fight Star.
Were they any good?
I only really knew Palahniuk's Laughter, the Fight Star song. They had a new single at the time. Feeder were good.
I don't know if I've ever heard a Fight Star song because at the time Fight Star was formed, I was so annoyed. I was with Charlie for breaking up Busted that I just was like, nah, you don't deserve this. Listen,
I genuinely bounced off when Busted split up. I was like, I refuse to believe in music. Kind of ruined music for me as a child for a little bit.
I didn't mind Year 3000, but I was like, I'm a couple of years older than you guys, or more than a couple. But I was like, when Busted were doing the rounds, my year group was like, ah, we're not into this. Right. And then when Fight Star happened, it was like, yeah, this is the
so
angry
for
teen.
Context: when Busted broke up, I would have been in Year 4 or Year 3, so I would have been like 7.
I don't know what I was.
And when it happened, one of my classmates like broke down in tears and had to be like taken aside by the teacher and like spoken to. Like, that's how significant Busted's fragmentation was.
It brought to my world. And I remember, I think he's called, it's Jason, right? One member of Busted who made the band Son of Dork afterwards. They released a single that I really liked, but then that didn't go anywhere. And I just thought, well, I can't trust anyone and I can't get invested in anything. And that's why I don't watch TV shows until they're finished.
That's fair enough. Can you remind Ewan of your bread ball reality?
Oh, yeah. But Ewan, when you were young, or even when you were
when I was old,
did you ever get like some bread, specifically white bread, if you had it in the house, ball it up into a solid ball take a bite out of it?
No.
If you were just like a bit, you know, a bit peckish, but you didn't.
Just did the bread, Josh.
No, but you don't want, no, but it changes consistency, it changes
right, so
flavor.
This is, the closest sort of ever have gotten to this would have been watching Teenage Ninja Turtles 2, The Secret of the Ooze, and discovering the new, like, the folded up pizza slice thing.
Yeah.
Which was like, that changed my life.
Folding pizza
was like,
folding the pizza
and like having it, that was fantastic. But I never got a slice of bread and decided to roll it up into it because I wasn't really a play with my food person. If I was going to have a bit of bread, I'd just take the slice and go.
I used to folding a fry. I was a kid, like folding a fry in half. I tell you, to this day, I'll snap a biscuit and fold it like sort of, like say a chocolate biscuit, snap that in half and then chocolate on chocolate and then dunk them both together.
What?
Maximum dunk.
What? But the teeth can't go through.
No, they can't. The teeth can go through.
You're not thinking about teeth penetration here.
Trust me, I've been doing it for 20 plus years. You get the most out of that biscuit. Dunk both sides at the same time.
You're having the same, it's the same basic
biscuit.
Man, this is the exact inversion of the bread thing for me because with the bread, the regular slice is too thin and doesn't feel dense enough, so I like to ball it up.
Get yourself some tiger bread. Get some thick bread.
You are obsessed with tiger bread.
Because you keep having bald bread.
You were trying to. You were absolutely employed by Big Tiger.
What is your standard loaf like? In terms of like, you got your hovis, you got your thick hovis, you got your meat normal hovis. If you're a Warburton's man, I'm going to walk out right now.
I'm a hovis seeded man right now.
That's good.
However, if I'm having white bread, I'm Warburton's baby.
Warburton's is the most disgusting bread ever. It tastes like cardboard.
If you ball it up, though, it might taste a little bit better.
If you contort the fibers and dimensions of the bread, it's okay. But nah.
Anyway, Scott, going back to what you said, because we cannot let this slide.
Please do.
When you break a biscuit in half, say a digestive, and put it on top of each other, like,
why do you want a biscuit to be that thick?
I want to fill in more. Well, one, I'm not satisfied by a single half of a biscuit.
Why
I can get more.
Why don't you just go for the chocolate hobnob life and satisfy
double them up.
What? I understand. Like, when I have a digestive,
double custard cream,
I will put that whole thing in my mouth because I understand. I want the majority of that thing at the same time, maximum taste. But I wouldn't put it on top of each other because that's changing the whole texture to me.
Not as much as you think.
No.
Depends how much you want the...
Wait. You just described this as like a game-changing thing, and now you say it's not that different.
Well, I'm trying to get him in. But I mean, I think it depends how much you enjoy your tongue touching the chocolate as opposed to the chocolate being in there regardless.
Are you a custard cream... what would you eat?
A twist and puller.
Are you deconstructing it?
No, hell no. I think all the deconstructed foods, I think that's a marketing gimmick. That stuff was never true. Deconstructed cheesecake is just someone who threw a cheesecake
The Oreo adverts used to fill me with such disgust.
It never happened, never worked in real life.
Well, no, I would never go. I literally was like, what the hell are you doing with that? Why are you licking the biscuit, you sick freak?
Yeah, they just really wanted it to be a thing.
Josh is screaming inside right now as a biscuit licker.
I do love a biscuit lick. I really do.
It's only even soft enough to lick it though.
No, but you can like get your teeth on it and go and like pull it down, and then you just get the lovely inside, and then you can dunk the remaining wafer.
Their biscuits lick.
Just a cup of tea.
Double them up and dunk two at the same time.
Adam Nicholas got me into a delicacy a few months ago, by the way. Okay. He introduced me to coffee in Biscoff biscuits.
Yeah.
And dunking them in. God, it's pornographic.
That's a dangerous game though, because the structural integrity of the Biscoff does not. If you're there, you're having a conversation, you forget for even half a second that Biscoff is in there.
Mm-hmm.
If you feel the heat coming around the corner, and you can't get out there.
This is a 2003 Peter Kay routine, but it is true that there is an art to dunking biscuits. My wife had never dunked biscuits before meeting me, and we sat and made a biscuit platter. And then we went through them
all. I like to have it in the mouth and then swash it down.
Really?
Can I tell you something horrific?
That's weird, that.
Yeah. Are you actually a pro melter?
Well, I've got to
Dave Melter, carry on.
One, putting something in your mouth and then taking a swig of something, I champion, because I don't necessarily do it with tea and biscuits.
I don't leave it in the mouth when I swig. Okay. I just there's the residue, there's the aftertaste.
That's freaky shit. How about this, though? And this is, I do not recommend this. You will be a nightmare for your dentist, but if I want to really treat myself, I'll get a sour sweet, maybe a Haribo Tangfastic, right?
Oh, good.
Put
good
it choice. In the mouth, and then take a swig of full fat Coke while I've still got the Tangfastic on my tongue. And let me tell you, boys, the taste sensation is outrageous.
What a rush.
Yet I need to, you know, go to the emergency room afterwards to get the teeth taken out.
Your teeth have got small jackets on them at this point.
Absolutely worth it. My girlfriend Talia introduced me to a delicacy yesterday that she saw on TikTok, which is, we've got a coffee machine at home, like where you use the pods and you press the button and the coffee comes out and it's all hot, et cetera, et cetera. So she saw on TikTok that you get a Kinder Bueno, one of the big ones. You place it on the top of your mug, right? You turn the coffee machine on and the hot coffee will hit the Kinder Bueno, melt the Kinder Bueno. You give it a little stir, put your milk in, and then you've got a Kinder Bueno tasting coffee. Absolutely sensational.
Have you verified this? Have you tried this?
I did it last night, yeah. Okay. Yeah, okay. We didn't do it. I keep my biscuits in the fridge, so it didn't melt.
What are you doing?
It needed a bit of maintenance, but it did eventually melt.
I thought you put your ketchup in the fridge. Splitting the Bueno purely aesthetic. Could you not just throw it in after you put it in?
You just stir it with a Kinder Bueno if you really want
to. This is me. I sound like an arse there. I actually love the theatre for this, to be honest.
No, you are right. Like if you're in a rush, yeah, you could just stir that bad boy in.
I'm here for the theatre. You've got to preserve the process, respect it.
If Scott is like one of those slow roasting mans when it comes to the coffee, I'm a slow Bueno man. I want to see the artistry of that thing.
The real Bueno dripper over
there. As opposed to a Rapido Bueno.
You don't get it wrong. We're going to completely flip this. I think it's just still a good question to do. From Lionheart Ash, who says, hey, legends, has a game ever got you through a tough time in your life?
Oh.
I always have a default for this, which is just Celeste, but only in terms of that game's portrayal of mental health, understanding what someone who was very close to me was going through. But at the same time, I have found that just for whatever reason, Cyberpunk... of over Christmas was really helpful. And I think there's there's a lot of stuff I'm going through at the minute in terms of prepping for being a dad, overthinking everything in regards to every second of my life that got me to this point, and making sure I'm aware of various life lessons that I want to pass on, etc. And it was really good thinking, like, oh, this is my last Christmas, this is my last one without being a dad. And it's not that that's a bad thing, I'm really looking forward to everything, but I'm just aware of it. And there was something about such a realized world and going through the Phantom Liberty DLC and just living this other life in Cyberpunk for like 2 weeks solid across the Christmas break that I absolutely loved. And there was just something about disconnecting in like a really good, believable way that just helped. And so I think that's not as specific as the Celeste thing in terms of the thematics mirroring what was happening in real life, but something about a playable escapist window can be so satisfying in like in a way that you are fully immersed in that other space.
Anything for you, Ewan?
Yeah, this is it's one of those where I feel like it's bad because I don't have any specific examples, because I feel like gaming, as someone who was bullied as a child,
same,
and gaming was a hobby as a result of that bullying and same, not really hanging out with a lot of people as a kid, it would be everything. Like, it's kind of like, it is like a therapeutic practice for me. Like, there's no specific life events. I just remember, like, feeling when I was most isolated, I could always just go in and embrace something wholeheartedly and you know, really do that. Because, like, I had this conversation with people the other week, I forget who it was with, but talking about like how when I was a kid there was loads of kids my age who were ashamed to like kids stuff. Like, yeah, I would go in and be like, I love the X-Men, me, and they'd be like, you're 8 years old and you love the X-Men, what the
hell?
I got
that with Looney Tunes. Yeah, I always love Looney Tunes.
So I just being able to fully embrace that in game form, I was like, I'm just gonna do it anyway, this is the best thing. And like, I have so many great gaming memories playing with my cousin and doing all this as
I'll
well.
Just
so,
quickly yeah, double that as well. Yeah, I think like as someone who was ruthlessly bullied through first school and half of middle school, I've talked about this on the podcast before, but like being able to regain some control and agency and purpose in a space was so vital, even though at the time you don't realize
very
that's
very validating.
Yeah, exactly. Like reclaiming some validity. You don't realize that's why you're gravitating it at the time. But retrospectively, I think it's why I was able to get so enmeshed in video games and love them so much, because it gave me some agency and power again in a space where I didn't have it in real life.
Hell yeah, man. I mean, I think we talked on the UBP a few weeks ago about like video games providing that, for me, ultimate escapism. Movies, music, or television, or comics, or books, or whatever, always leave a part of my brain open, whereas games engage it on such a complete level where it's the only outlet I have where I can properly escape problems.
And totally.
We talked on the UBP how that can be a good thing and also a bad thing if you're relying on it too much. But in terms of specific games, honestly, man, it sounds crazy to say, but I genuinely think Call of Duty Warzone has saved my life twice. No joke. Once during the pandemic, where it became something to look forward to
hanging with the boys
every single day. Yep, and a reconnection with the boys. I hadn't played online with my friends in years. I just kind of, we got too busy, we kind of got out the loop, I didn't really stay in touch, and then suddenly it was this point of contact, so we were going on. It kind of became a second life and a second job, because I was getting through the workday looking forward to spending 5 hours a night on Call of Duty Warzone, right, to level up my guns, to get better with the boys, and then just to hang out. And then, you know, 4 years later, when I was off work last year, it popped up again in my time of need, and suddenly Call of Duty Warzone 2, with its latest array of maps in Modern Warfare 3, again, it gave me a purpose at a time where I was severely lacking it, because I was off work, which was my choice and was definitely good for me, but also meant that I didn't have a routine, didn't have any kind of anchoring throughout the days, and that game gave me that sort of sense of anchoring, you know,
yeah,
gave
man,
me
totally.
Something, it sounds dumb, gave me something to get up for in the morning, because I knew at least I was going to be leveling up on that game, you know? It allowed me to function like a normal human throughout the hours of the day, rather than just sleeping in until 3 and going to bed at 8.
I don't know if it's the same for you, but like for me, my friends are like scattered across the country. So gaming for me is become the way of hanging out with people, because like Skype calls or like Google Meet calls, whatever, they exhaust me, you know? Even when it's for something fun. So if it's a game, I can just hang out and like play Helldivers with the boys and just scream stupid stuff together. Like, that's, it's nice having a laugh that way.
Yeah, I think it's interesting seeing the industry respond to that as well. Like, the idea that people do treat online spaces as like the new like MSN, the new chat room or whatever. But then like the flip side of that being like, well, we'll just give you some stuff to do. And then the mission design gets all watered down, which is why Helldivers 2 is so good, because the game side of it is as good as what it feels like to reconnect with everybody and then play through that thing together. Question from Vince, who says, would love to hear your first wow next gen moment. I distinctively remember the moment my mum walked into the room watching me and my friend play FIFA 08 on the PlayStation 3.
Yes!
Asking, oh, are you guys watching soccer?
Yes!
Best of luck with a little one coming soon, Scott. Thank you very much. Yeah, I mean, it's going to be any generation. For me, it was Metal Gear Solid 2.
Yeah,
too. Right, yeah, it was Snake on the Verrazano Bridge, I think it's called. Walking up, actually, no, I guess it'd be the Manhattan Bridge at the time. And walking up and down that bridge, the first time we saw that, it is a cutscene, but it's also in-game. I recorded that using a video cassette tape so I could watch it over and over again. And that's definitely mine. Metal Gear Solid 2 was a, oh my God, games can look like this moment. And that was 2001.
This makes no sense because it's not even the best. It didn't even look amazing at the time it came out. But Marvel Ultimate Alliance was the game that I wanted an Xbox 360 for. And I used to read, there was a magazine in the UK called Marvel Rampage. And it was devoted entirely to Marvel comics, Marvel movies, Marvel just culture in general. Mm-hmm. And they were reporting on this game for like 2 whole years. It came out in 2006. It was announced in like 2004 at the end of that. And the hype for that. And I remember just being blown away by the Blur Studios like trailer that they did for that.
Yeah. Right.
The opening cutscene for NBA.
Oh, the cutscene's
like,
so
brilliant.
Good.
But then they also had the way they revealed that game with the, like they had a website where they had the entire roster and the whole thing was like, you can play as like 40 characters, and they'd have like the mystery things, they reveal them like once a month or whatever. Mm-hmm. That was exciting. The character models, I remember the renders for them, I was like, oh my God, these look amazing. And like, even like the gameplay, like I just, that for me was like, in retrospect, it didn't look anywhere near as good as other quote unquote next gen games that were being revealed for the 360. But that was my, oh my God.
I think I've got a couple, like one was definitely Metal Gear Solid 2. The first time I played the demo for that thing, I just thought, oh my God, just the way the lighting made that tanker mission look, the rain, the particle effects,
it's still stunning
quality
now.
On yes, like it's still Snake stunning. Man and the characters, even like the way you could hold up the enemies and kind of shoot individual body parts, which is probably something a 7-year-old shouldn't have had.
I was doing that too,
but you know, it was impressive, and I was like, whoa, what a technical innovation.
What will happen if I shoot them in the balls?
Yeah, literally. Oh, he's grabbing his balls.
They did account for that, yeah.
Yeah, they really did. But a couple more. I didn't have internet until extremely late, so when I was getting previews for a game, it was all through magazines. Yeah. And I remember reading a preview for Grand Theft Auto 4 where the developers were talking about how realistic the world was, and they specifically mentioned that the character's feet will interact with every step when they're walking up a flight of stairs. And that blew my mind. That I was talking about that nonstop. If you're wondering why I'm obsessed with like ear cartilage effects to this day, it's because of GTA 4.
That and in like the marketing, like next gen stuff, The Force Unleashed and Indiana Jones game that eventually became Stafford.
The Euphoria
Kings,
engine.
Which was not what it was initially meant to be. But the Euphoria and Havoc stuff that LucasArts were discussing when they were making Force Unleashed, like that was like, whoa, this is amazing.
I remember you mentioned the foot thing. I remember like the little small things that would always get put in the gaming magazines of like when San Andreas was being previewed. I remember the person describing a character chewing gum, and that was like incredible that the mouth would rotate. And it's like when you look at the animation, it's just taking the rig and it rotating the chin, but it worked. And I remember Splinter Cell Pandora Tomorrow, there was a big deal that you could walk through material that was hanging, like different robes and drapes and stuff, and it would go around Sam as you walked through it. That was like phenomenal as well.
I remember reading as well, because I love it how, I guess the art of this is kind of lost now with so much video content out there, but your mind would like imagine things that were way more, you know, fantastical than what was actually, you know, doable at the time. But I remember reading a preview for Brothers in Arms, I think it was Hell's Highway, and they were describing the teammate AI in that game and how when you were, you know, running from cover to cover, your teammates will react humanly as they describe. They might trip on a bit of
debris and kind of fall over. They'll be scrambling. They won't just be moving from place to place. Mm-hmm. And I thought, this is going to be the most realistic game of all time. This is going to be the most human AI I've ever seen. And it was pretty good in game, but mm-hmm. it was not how I imagined it to be.
No, all those assumptions. I did the exact same thing. Like that assumption that it's going to be this entire literal world you're going to step into. And then they just freeze on the spot. And
it's like in Force Unleashed, the whole big thing being like, if you grab a stormtrooper, they might grab onto the rails.
They want to live.
Yeah.
But that was they were just magnetized or something. Final question from Oversoul Gaming, who says, what are your thoughts on the recent rise in what the film industry is calling elevated horror? Horror films that rely on artsy cinematography and dark storytelling versus the usual horror tropes. Think Hereditary, Talk to Me, pretty much anything with A24's name on it.
I think elevated horror, for me, has been around for so
good
long
few years
now
yeah.
that I almost feel like we're seeing the response to it. And there are still, of course, elevated horror movies still being made, like they mentioned, you know, A24 and Talk to Me, which I thought was absolutely incredible. Mm-hmm. But I like it. I think it's a bit, I don't want to say pretentious. I don't like using that word necessarily, but I don't like it when, especially, you know, kind of like official movie bodies kind of legitimize elevated horror above regular horror. That's arguably doing the exact same thing with the exact same level of artistry for decades now, right?
It's the worst term that they could have saddled these movies with because I feel like it does, it puts them on a pedestal compared to other aspects of horror, which are just as, it's kind of like condescending genre, isn't it, in a way? And like, I don't think the movies themselves are doing that, and I think like there are great examples of it. I don't have a response to what you would call it instead of elevated horror because it's a label that has stuck. Mm-hmm. But for me, it's always been a bit weird because I've seen these kinds of horror movies in that space for decades prior, so mm-hmm. it always kind of weirds me out. Like a Texas Chainsaw Massacre came out in 2020, would they have called that elevated horror?
Because
it's
you know,
I mean, they're like, would you have called Psycho elevated horror? Like, for me, it's just a little bit weird and nebulous as a phrase. I don't quite like
it. It's definitely like these movies that are cited here. What's that one I always forget the name of where it's the It Comes at Night?
Yes.
That was more of a victim of its marketing where they sort of seemed to imply there was a creature, there was something, like, go watch it and see what this is. And then it wasn't. The general point of that movie is whatever you feel in regards to being default hostile at night is the feeling kind of thing. And it's like, I think it's overall the elevated horror thing to me feels like it's in that grouping of, if you have to interpret the ending, if it's not spelled out, then it's elevated horror.
That's,
I feel
it,
like Hereditary really set it in motion.
I have a problem with the term, but the trend itself, I thought came around, especially when it was needed the most. Like, elevated horror never really went away, but horror at the start of the 2010s was in a pretty bad space.
You want more Conjuring, brother?
Yeah, I like the Conjuring. That's how bad it was. But yeah, it felt like we were getting to this place where, especially in the mainstream, it was very diluted, and the low budget stuff that was coming in was quite fun in many places, but wasn't getting much recognition and wasn't doing well in terms of, like, I don't know, even in terms of, like, critically, it was just kind of like there. It was kind of, you know, it felt very straight to DVD in a way. Whereas when we started getting movies like The Babadook and Hereditary and, you know, the entire wave that spawned, it was, studios started to back it in a way that they weren't previously, and suddenly we had this entire new kind of sub-industry of horror that was well-funded, attracting great talent, and was getting, you know, marketed well to a big audience because elevated horror became such a known term and an antidote, I think, to what was going on in the mainstream at the time, which was definitely diluted, I think.
I think as well, like, as much as you can have, like, good, fun, back-to-basic slashes, like, for me, like, I got so bored with the new Halloween movies, like, the rebooted ones. Like,
it's so annoying, because, like, I liked the first one,
right,
and then I loved Kills, which makes me a pariah because I know people hate that movie. But yeah, sorry not to interject
that. No, I mean, that works, like, in terms of, like, it does still work. Like, it's such a formula. I think because I did so much, like, film study stuff in high school and whatever, horror is so easy to dissect if you're looking at the basics of the genre itself. Like, you can tell the camera angles, when the jump scare is going to come, etc. And for me, it gets so boring watching that. So, like, I love the elevated stuff or something more than just slasher template 101 or jump scare or the volume spike jump scare is, like, one of the most tired things you could do.
That's interesting, man, because, I mean, I'm on the other side of that coin because, I mean, I did bloody film school for my entire university degree, you know what I mean? And that only made me love the genre more.
Right.
Like, horror is by far my favorite genre in games and in movies, you know? And I like both the elevated aspect that does try to bring a, I don't know, it tries to dabble maybe in other genres, but then you've got, like, what I would describe as conventional horror movies that still are thrilling and still work, even if they are kind of rote. Like, I still like the big Blumhouse movies when they come out. And like, I was a huge fan of The Conjuring, but I like that elevated horror made for the kind of like two popular paths moving forward. It didn't like sort of suffocate anything else and allowed a nice alternative to the mainstream fare, I suppose.
Yeah, that's fair. We will wrap up the podcast up. But yeah, for that stuff, I love, we talked about it before, I always like refer to it as like conceptual horror. Like, I love It Follows or like The Thing or whatever, like something that has a more unique hook to it, or like an entity, or like something that can't be understood or something like that. I think that can sometimes, I think that can elevate the genre, but it's not what would be classed as elevated horror. I think the term at the minute seems to be more like interpretational endings or interpretational plot points. Or things where you just didn't get it. Half the audience got it and the other audience half didn't get it, and then we need a term to be like, well, you know, it's an elevated horror, so it's not, you know, it's necessarily supposed to get it. And finding a way to navigate through it on a marketing side.
It is interesting, man, because it's like, I totally get where you're coming from, and I know fine well why those associations are associated with elevated horror specifically. But I think you go back and look at like some of the greats and even the not so greats, like that division in the audience has always been there for the best horror
people
movies.
People didn't understand The Thing when it came out. Like, it was critically reviled. People like walked out in disgust at what it was trying to achieve.
I guess same with like The Shining. Yeah. You know,
I was going to say
the thing that frustrates me slightly around the elevated horror conversation is that I do think that people mistake genre as an idea of like tropes, and not actually that these movies can interrogate tropes in a way that isn't the quote unquote elevated approach. It's the same thing that action gets hit with. You know, like there are some great action movies where people look at them and go, oh, it's just dumb fun. But in reality, they're actually saying something quite deep and meaningful, whether it's like genre introspection or maybe making, you know, a socio-political point or whatever. And I feel like you get that with even what you would call like classic, like genre fare. Like they're all, like no one can tell me that Nightmare on Elm Street 3 Dream Warriors isn't an amazing technical showcase, even though it's not quote unquote elevated, if that makes sense.
No,
there are always ways for horror movies that exist in what, like a certain space to do something meaningful and value, even if they're playing with tropes and genre convention is what I would say. But I think that's one of those where it's just kind of people think of genre and they think of, oh, it's going to hit these beats, but like you can hit those beats interestingly and rejig them and do something.
Yeah, it's like how much charm and soul and purpose is coming through, and does it feel studio mandated, which I guess was the case for me with the third of the newest Halloween movies. But anyway, this has been the Untitled Banter Podcast. I've been your host, Scott Tilford, joined by Ewan Patterson.
Goodbye.
Joined by Josh Brown.
Bye-bye.
Thank you all very much for listening. I didn't do a standard outro. I'll say UBP, 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 and we'll catch you all very soon. Goodbye.
Yeah.
Bread balls.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.